Friday, February 12th. And so we're dealing with the tail end of chapter 23. Okay, so we're looking at the nutritional aspects, requirements of THF. So that's why you have to have it. And lots of growth going on inside of you. So let's take a look at since it's a water-soluble vitamin, you do need more of it than you do need than others. Some of the risk factors, of course, are poor diet, alcoholism, which is typically you can consume a liter of whiskey a day if you're an alcoholic. And so they get their calories. There's not a bit of folic acid in any of those calories of alcohol. And so they could end up, you know, having plenty of energy and no folic acid. Elderly, it's simply poor nutrition. The elderly just get tired. They get bored. Their mind begins to slow down, and they just don't have the same impetus to eat. I can't imagine being so old that I would not want to eat, but it happens. Food preparation, dilution of cooking water. That means it simply leaches out of it. Destruction by heat. Long-term frozen storage will also do that to you. Pregnancy. This is where you're going to find folic acid problems. It's widespread. It's utilized by the fetus and lost by lactation. So the worst possible scenario for you, in terms of, not for you, but for a woman in terms of requirement for for folic acid, if you're both pregnant and lactating for a baby that you already have. That does happen every once in a while. It's not too often, but it does. My wife's boss has two sons that are like a year and a half apart, which means that, you know, she got pregnant within 6 months or so after having the first baby. And so, at any rate, so what can happen is if you have a severe deficiency of this, assuming you're not pregnant, you can end up having something known as a megaloblastic anemia. And so you need to underline this as a deficiency for folic acid. This tends to happen in undeveloped countries. People who in that, they typically drink goat's milk, but it's got a poor source of folate and vitamin B12. They many times heat the goat's milk, and that destroys the folate as well. What can happen is if you have a vitamin B12 deficiency, it induces folate deficiency required from methionine synthase. If you recall methionine synthase, do you remember where that was here? Let's see if we can find that. Is that on this? Is that in here? Methionine synthase? I think it was. If you look at this particular enzyme right here, this is methionine synthase. Methionine synthase on the previous pages on this same handout, page number 4, it looks like. Methionine synthase has, and that's where an interrelationship between vitamin B12 and THF occur, because methionine synthase requires vitamin B12. It's the second of the two enzymes that require vitamin B12 that exist in your body. Methionine synthase and that that methylmalonyl mutase is the other one, if you recall. All right, well, we're not going to burden us with this, but vitamin B12 initiates that. Symptoms of both deficiencies are shared, so if as a physician or whatever, or as a pharmacist or other healthcare professional, someone begins to present symptoms of a vitamin B12 deficiency, you also have to consider that perhaps it's a folic acid problem as well. Epilepsy, there are certain drugs create a folate deficiency if you've got epilepsy. But if you try to overcome that by providing additional folate, it can actually increase the rate of seizures. I'm not sure they know the mechanism of it. Primarily, how do you measure blood folate? Blood serum or red blood cell folate levels. If you are pregnant and you do not have enough sufficient folic acid in your diet, you can end up having neural tube defects. That's the neural tube is the developmental part of from brainstem down to the base of your spine. That's the neural tube. And so if you don't have enough of folic acid, you can have problems. Part of the developing human embryo begins to form 18 days following conception. 18 days following conception, you begin to form a neural tube. Neural tube seals and closes. Says OF. That should be OFF. Seals off and closes, thus forming a tube by the 30th day after conception. Any drug, nutrient imbalance, or genetic defect that interferes with this stage of development may prevent normal closure of the tube, resulting in defects of the newborn. The least severe neurotube defect may require examination of the spinal cord by a physician. Many times as the baby grows, even in and outside of the womb, the tube will, if it's covered by skin, will spontaneously close. The most severe neural tube deficiency may lead to an absence of a brain. That's called anencephaly. But the most common are spina bifida. Ever hear of spina bifida? This is the spinal cord at the lumbar vertebra are not covered with bone. And so it's basically right up in between your shoulders, I believe, where the lumbar things are. Lumbar vertebra are vertebrae. They can, the marvelous thing about this is, with today's modern medicine, and be grateful you live in today's society, is that sometimes even though you take sufficient folic acid, you have this spina bifida. So this is not the only reason for spina bifida. It's one of them, but it's not the only reason. But they can spot this using ultrasound, by the 6th month of pregnancy. They can spot that it's not closing properly, or even earlier. And so they have been able to completely ameliorate the symptoms of this by doing in utero surgery. They literally punch through the amniotic through your uterus into the amniotic sac where you are, where the baby is, you were, where the baby is, and using a very simple remote tools, what all they do is they simply surgically they suture close that opening that's there. So you've got basically a hole, elongated hole right here. It's got skin and everything with it. It's just a hole. And all they need to do is simply pull the pieces of skin to cover that hole. You just simply literally cover it, and that initiates the rest of the development. Just closing that hole mechanically with sutures initiates the appropriate rest of the development. You get bone in there. The baby comes out perfect. Fine. Not a single symptom remaining for the rest of their natural life. Completely normal. So it is a marvelous thing. Current FDA recommendations include the commercial flour and cereal products be modified with 1.4 milligrams of folic acid per kilogram to prevent this. This also seems to lower homocysteine levels. High level homocysteine correlate with atherosclerosis. Atherosclerosis. This is the accumulation of fatty plaques on the inside your arteries. Vitamin B deficiency. Supplementation with folic acid may have a common symptom of vitamin B deficiency, which would be that megaloblastic anemia or pernicious anemia. The anemia is not present, but the nerve damage due to vitamin T deficiency continues. You got to check for both. All right. Now, what we're going to do now is we're going to switch to the overhead because there are some important terms here that are available on the overhead that are not available on the on these notes here. And so we'll get to that right now. Now, if you would please refer to the handout I just gave you today. The handout I gave you today should contain these notes on them. And I'm just going to leave it down here in the corner so it becomes almost impossible to read. Oh, there we go. we go. All right. So what this source is, we have just taken a short break to go through some amino acid biosynthesis and blah, 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 and folic acid and THF and all that kind of stuff. Now we're looking at some branch chain amino acids. Now, if you notice in your notes, the branch chain amino acid has an abbreviation called BCAA. So if I use that in a test or a quiz, you ought to know what BCAA stands for, which is what? Thank you very much. Now, most branch chain amino acids are used for fuel if they're not used for biosynthesis. So the metabolism of this, again, typically is, starts in the muscle. Production of NADH makes the excellent source for energy, which means you see right here, you see this process. You take these various branch chains, and they have unique enzymes that... Notice what's happening here in the very first step. You have an alpha-ketoglutarate going to glutamate. What's happening there in that first step? Transamination, and what happens to glutamate? You got it. I mean, you know, what happens to glutamate? Anybody else want to... He said it, transamination, but what is glutamate? It's what? Yes, it's produced by transamination, but what is its ultimate fate then? You have this glutamate, so what? What happens with the glutamate? There are two amino acids that are used as a pool to hold nitrogens prior to their entry into the what cycle? Urea cycle. So this glutamate right here is a pool that they use to hold the nitrogens prior to the entry into the urea cycle. Urea, I just met a girl named Urea. At any rate, so here you got that branch chain. You got rid of the nitrogen here. And the next step, which is, I've got, that's a 7 here, and we'll look at what's going over here. The 7 then, the number 2 reaction produces NADH and carbon dioxide. And there you make more FADH. So you're oxidizing. You begin to oxidize those amino acid chains, the carbon backbones, pretty almost immediately. The BCAA aminotransferase exists at high concentrations in muscles. So this number 1 and the number 1 here exists in high concentrations of muscles. That's what this says, number 3, but this is just 0.3. This actually deals with step number 1. Starvation induces the BCAA enzymes. Normally, I should say that, you know, at least in the muscles, you don't use, while it can be a source for energy, most branch chain amino acids are not used for energy, but they are used for energy under starvation circumstances. So starvation induces that muscle BCAA enzymes. Fed state induces the BCAA enzymes in liver. So number 4 and 5 are important ideas there. Skip number 6. You don't have to recall any of this stuff. Let's go over and take a look at number 7. Number 7 is an interesting metabolic disease that occurs. It's a genetic disease. Mutation of the number 2 enzyme, which is that first dehydrogenase that begins the oxidation of the branch chain amino acids, the carbon skeleton of it, which is called BC, keto acid dehydrogenase. If that is not working, it causes an excretion of branch chain alpha keto acids. In other words, if this doesn't work, then you've got all these alpha keto acids that are beginning to build up in your liver or in your muscle tissue, and they get dumped into the bloodstream. And branch chain alpha keto acids, oddly enough, in combination with the other things in the urine, produces a urine that smells like maple syrup. And so many times that's the first indication that there's some sort of genetic problem with the baby. The baby's going fine, looks fine, acts fine, but the parents say, man, you know, whenever he or she tinkles, the diaper smells like syrup, maple syrup, literally. And when you hear that, the doctor's head just jerks up and goes, "What? Really? Okay." At any rate, and there is an effective treatment, and that is a diet low in branched-chain amino acids, and they can eventually outgrow it. But some people are linked always to having a diet low in branched-chain amino acids, and you can create a nutritional diet. It may not be very fun, but you can create a nutritional diet that's low in branched-chain amino acids and have a normal life. All right, so the rest of this is an interesting thing of chemistry. So you end up, you basically have those alpha keto acids. You connect them to a CoA, and then you've got these branched chain, short chains of carbons attached to that CoA, and they can go through a series of reactions that eventually either end up in propionyl CoA, and end up then in succinyl CoA, which then goes to pyruvate, which either can go to glucose or the TCA cycle, or there's others that end up with acetyl-CoA and acetoacetate. So here is the bottom line. I want you to know the four compounds that are the fates of branched-chain amino acid degradation. Four. There are four compounds. Actually, I guess three. I take that back, three. There are three compounds that are the fate of branched-chain amino acids. First one is acetyl-CoA, and we see that twice. I don't want you to memorize this. I just want you to know that the ultimate fate of branched-chain amino acids are acetyl-CoA, acetoacetate, or succinyl-CoA. Now, acetoacetate, where have we seen acetoacetate before? Acetoacetate. What is it? What? Fatty acid. Well, fatty acid, not synthesis, but close. Metabolism as what? What are they? Ketone bodies. Name the three ketone bodies. Yes, exactly. Let's do this in alphabetical order. Acetoacetate is the first one. Acetone is the next one, and the last one is beta-hydroxybutyrate. All right. Those are basically can be thought of as water-soluble fat equivalents. Water-soluble fat equivalents. Okay. Now, there's some argument about what's an essential amino acid and what isn't, because some of these amino acids can be synthesized from other amino acids, which are essential. So if you have an amino acid that's synthesized from an essential amino acid, is the one that you synthesized from it essential too? I don't know. So all I need for you to do is I need for you to recall B, and that is Private Tim Hall. Okay, that'll get you 99% of the time, that'll tell you what the essential amino acids are. Private, see the PVT is private, or you could PVT pressure temperature, pressure volume temperature, if you want to do a little PCAM. Yeah. Tim Hall, phenylalanine, valine, tryptophan, threonine, isoleucine, methionine, histidine, arginine, leucine, lysine. Private Tim Hall. I will likely ask questions about that. All right. Now, the next, at page 8. Do you have a page 8? Yeah. All right. Now, this is there are many complicated amino acids. There are many simple ones. I'm going to ask you to know some simple ones. So, what I want you to know is the biosynthesis of these three amino acids, which are alanine, asparagine, and glutamine. Very simple. I need for you to know the reactants and the products. And they're almost always a one or two. Well, actually, there's five amino acids right here. You got alanine, aspartate, glutamate. And then you got asparagine, glutamine. Anyway, so you can see here that pyruvate is the source for alanine, oxaloacetate is the source for aspartate, and alpha-ketoglutarate is the source for glutamate. Now, where do you find pyruvate, oxaloacetate, and alpha-ketoglutarate in the cell? Where do you find that compound? I'm sorry, what is it? Citric acid cycle, that's right. That's why I have Krebs, Krebs, and Krebs here. All right? That's why the Krebs cycle. So let me ask you this question. If you're withdrawing oxaloacetate to make asparagine, that means the citric acid cycle is shutting down, doesn't it? If you're withdrawing oxaloacetate to make asparagine, you're going to shut down the citric acid cycle, right? And then you're going to die. So how often do you make asparagine and aspartic acid? Well, you make it a lot. Because while you're withdrawing this, yes, you're withdrawing it, but is the citric acid cycle shutting down? See, no. Because there are the other reactions that are filling it up. Filling it up. I bet there's a fancy Latin-based term for that. What? Let's see. What is that called? Anapleretic. Yes. Have you read that novel? It's the sequel to Anna of Green Gables. It's called Anapleretic. Sorry. Really, 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 really a stretch on that one, wasn't it? All right. So, yeah. So we got the anapleretic. What is the primary anapleretic reaction? Do you remember? It's also the first reaction in gluconeogenesis. Pyruvate carboxylase. That's exactly correct. Pyruvate carboxylase is the primary anapleretic reaction that fills up the citric acid cycle, the Krebs cycle, once these things are removed. Well, anyway, enough of that. Now, there are important physiological amines, because I'm going to change the subject right now. Can you tell? Just a little bit. We're near the tail end of this thing. We're looking at, basically this chapter was dealing with nitrogen and related items. So we got this nitrogen. There are other, lots of important amine, physiologically active amines are an important class of compound in your body. They are a lot of the hormones that are hormones and important neurotransmitters that we will be dealing with in the next week or so. Now, my bottom line here is I'm going to ask you to match the name with the structure at a very minimum. That's what you need to be able to identify is the name and structure. I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate the structure. Just match them. Just match them. All these, well, not all of these, but these first two are called catecholamines, because they have a benzene ring with a hydroxy group on it as part of their structure. But this first one, called epinephrine, norepinephrine, or dopamine, are tyrosine derivatives, as you can tell. Serotonin is a tryptophan derivative. A gamma-aminobutyric acid, which is a powerful neurotransmitter, is glutamate as a resource. And histamine uses histidine as a derivative. So, for those of you who have terrible allergies and that histamine, which is a naughty chemical, causes all kinds of misery around your nose and eyes and stuff, that's all based on histidine as a product of histidine. All right. Go on from there. Now then. You don't need to know this yet. I think, and I'm repeating what I just said earlier, that is, you match the neurotransmitter with its name. This says not for Biochem 421, but of course we're in 422, so this doesn't count. You have to do this. Match the neurotransmitter with its structure. And so you got epinephrine, norepinephrine, dopamines. That's what these. So this is in addition to the previous four that you saw, here are these three down here. And all this begins with tyrosine. Now, so here is tyrosine, and there's a tyrosine hydroxylase, which is actually directly oxidized by oxygen, which is a very powerful and dangerous reaction that the body goes through. Anytime you directly oxidize something using oxygen, you're going to have some issues with perhaps making peroxides and stuff, which are deadly. But that uses the enzyme tyrosine hydroxylase, but it uses a cofactor called dihydrobiopterin. And as oxygen is used, it changes from dihydrogen to tetrahydrogen. So there's a hydrogen process that has to be added. Hydrogen has to be added on this dihydrobiopterin. There's a reduction then that has to go right here. All right, can you see that in the handout that I gave you? Yeah, all right, good. This is by something called dihydrobiopterin reductase. And the loss of that reductase by mutation causes severe neurological problems. So the genetic disease can be an issue right there. With that, we will not get into the kind of problems that it is, but it is. Now then, the tyrosine makes L-DOPA. L-DOPA makes dopamine. Dopamine makes norepinephrine. Epinephrine. Norepinephrine makes epinephrine. Dopamine makes... Another name for norepinephrine is noradrenaline. Another name for epinephrine is adrenaline. Noradrenaline and adrenaline were originally used in the United States in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, but they've now been supplanted by the terms norepinephrine and epinephrine, but it's the same compound. And just as a quick note, going backwards, and now that we get near the end, we're going to go backwards a little bit more. The serotonin that you see right here, this tryptophan derivative, this serotonin is the happy hormone. It apparently has an important role to play in physiological contentment, as it were. Now, last and least is nitrogen fixation. Where does all that nitrogen that you have floating around in your amines and amino acids and your DNA and RNA, where does all that nitrogen come from? Well, you don't fix nitrogen directly. You can't breathe nitrogen and make amines out of it. So what has to happen is bacteria will do it for you, but only if they're coddled very, very carefully. So biochemically, what happens here is you have one nitrogen molecule, eight hydrogen ions, eight electrons, the equivalent of 16 ATP, 16 water, and that'll get you two ammonia molecules, a little bit of hydrogen, ATP, and some phosphate, ADP and some phosphate. This, of course, all occurs at room temperature, not even at 37 degrees, but at room temperature in plants, and at atmospheric pressure. So it's really a spectacular biochemical triumph to be able to capture nitrogen gas and turn it into ammonia. Because that nitrogen gas, do you remember what the structure of nitrogen gas is? How many bonds does a nitrogen have? Nitrogen molecule. What is the Lewis electron dot diagram for nitrogen? How many bonds are connecting the two nitrogen atoms? There should be three. Right. One, two, three. A big old hairy triple bond, and it's very stable. Right? Big old hairy triple bond. It's very stable. What percentage of the air that you're breathing is, in fact, nitrogen gas? Right, 70, 75%. Right. What percent is oxygen? About 18%. What percent is water vapor? Varies where you are, but it's between 0 and 4%. What percent is carbon dioxide? 0.03 or 0.035%. That's correct. Yep, That's what nitrogen. That's what carbon dioxide is. And so the plants, as you know from the C4 metabolism and from other Caecilian acid metabolism, are desperate to try to increase the concentration of carbon dioxide. They would love to have it in the atmosphere. All right, so now, so this triple bond is very hard to break. Very hard to break. And it is an energy-requiring process, unlike if you break a triple bond like...
You see, like acetylene is HC triple bond CH. You combine that with oxygen to get carbon dioxide and water, and you get plus lots of energy out of it because you're both breaking the triple bond and oxidizing it. But here, when you with the nitrogen, you're breaking that triple bond and then reducing it. And the reduction, as you know, takes energy. Photosynthesis or oxidative electron transport in certain bacteria. So there's a ferredoxin that begins to act and gets oxidized and reduced and transfers those electrons to an iron protein intermediate that then interacts with a molybdenum iron protein matrix in combination with ATP begin to reduce that iron, molybdenum iron protein intermediate. And just like, you remember how the manganese ion in the oxygen evolving complex, you know, an electron was removed and it increased its oxidation state, and another electron was removed, increased its oxidation state, and another electron, four electrons removed from manganese, and eventually got to be such a strong oxidizing state that it could remove electrons from water. Well, here, this eventually gains so much, so many electrons, and so much energy, so highly reduced, that it actually can force electrons onto the nitrogen along with hydrogens and produce this ammonia and hydrogen gas. And immediately that ammonia is captured by alpha-ketoglutarate and put in a glutamate pool that then is used for biosynthesis for all the other amino acids. This enzyme right here, this thing, is a nitrogenase catalyzed reduction of nitrogen. So the enzyme that this is a part of, this is a multi-protein complex, is called nitrogenase, and uses a tremendous amount of electrons and a tremendous amount of ATP. Now, do you know where most of the nitrogen fixation goes on in our modern world? Well, most of the nitrogen fixation in our modern world is a industrial complex using what's known as the Haber process. Haber was a chemist in World War I in Germany. And he used a lead catalyst with high-pressure atmospheric hydrogen, high temperatures, and high-pressure hydrogen. And it just forced the hydrogen onto the nitrogen to produce ammonia. The reason why it was done there in World War I is because, previous to this, all the nitrogen compounds that are used for explosives were taken from nitrate deposits found in Bolivia and Peru and shipped into Europe. Well, the British put a blockade around Germany, and so they could not bring in those compounds from those sources, and they were running out of explosives. And so this chemist, Haber, came up with this process, and by capturing that as ammonia, they could then use ammonia to make the explosives. And the war, if they'd run out of explosives, the war would have been over 2 years earlier than what it actually had been, because they were that close to running out of explosives. Turns out that his extending the war for 2 years essentially killed another million or so soldiers total in those last 2 years. Haber turns out to be a Jew.
a German nationalist Jew. What that means is that he was very gung-ho, patriotic German. And he was very proud of his process that enabled them to continue the war as long as they did. What happened, of course, is that the Allies at the end of World War I were so punitive against Germany and it imposed such horrible reparations on them that it set up the agitation, the discontent that eventually put Hitler in power. And then Hitler ended up killing all of Haber's family. Haber was dead by that time, but his family was consumed by the Holocaust. No good deed goes unpunished. At any rate. Okay, now, I'm not done with that with this particular process because there's a couple things I want to go back to look at. Oh, no, we're not done. Okay, we've got one more page, don't we? And we got to do this quickly. Protein digestion absorption. Do you have this handout? It's on the old one, it's not on the new one? Okay. Well, that's too bad. I didn't realize that. Okay. So you have it on the old one. There's not much new on the, there's no notes to write down necessarily for that. Let's quickly run through this. I'm running out of time. Protein absorption exudes exogenous and endogenous amounts. Between 25 and 200 grams of the protein that you absorb every day comes from you, ladies and gentlemen. Your digestive enzymes that are then themselves digested, and protein that's sloughed off in your digestive tract. Especially the cells in your cheeks are sloughed off. 1 to 2 grams of nitrogen lost through feces a day. Polypeptides are not absorbed in the intestine. Only free amino acids along with di and tripeptides are absorbed. Initial digestion occurs in the stomach. Low pH destroys bacteria. Denatures the proteins. Proteases include endopeptidases and ectopeptidases. Pancreatic peptidases activate in small intestine. Enteropeptidase converts trypsin to trypsin. And so the inactive trypsin precursor is called trypsinogen, and trypsin is activated to trypsin by trypsin, the trypsin that's already there. Then trypsin then in turn activates the chymotrypsin, elastase, and carboxypeptidases. And then the pancreatic juice contains a trypsin inhibitor until it lands into your intestinal tract. Brush border cells, that's the cells right along the lining your intestinal tract. Digest the smaller pieces, surface concentrated endopeptidases and aminopeptidases. The free amino acids and dietries are absorbed by specific transporters. So this is where all the digestive chyme is, all the food is. There are specific transporters for everything it brings in. The fatty acids, there's some diffusion, but everything else gets transported in. All the sugars and all the amino acids have a specific transporter. Large proteins absorbed are di and tripeptides. These are further digested by cytosolic enzymes. And what's floating in your bloodstream is 99% free amino acids. 99% free amino acids. Every once in a while, there's a few di or tries that slip through. Nothing's perfect, but they're not harmful, and they can be readily digested by enzymes that are available to do other things. All right, let's see here. One last thing is, of course, no, that's it. I'm just going to make some comment. You have a quiz today, don't you? That's annoying. I just got going and forgot to stop. All right. What do I want to do with this thing? This thing is... I know what we're going to do. We're still going to make it a... What will happen is I'm going to make this quiz available with Grace's next in the office next week. So come by any time next week and take this quiz. Okay? Just like the good old metabolic quizzes. And expect another quiz on Friday of next week. Okay? Even though we only have one day of lecture. Okay? Thank you very much. We will see you later, alligator. And I'd like to thank everybody for being quiet and not saying a thing about that. I appreciate it, letting me just ramble onward, not warning me.
I know that lecturing is your passion.
Yeah, I'll take your handouts. Yeah, don't want to get in the way of you.
We thought you might have been more perturbed if we had interrupted.
Oh, well, you're very thoughtful. I don't believe it, but you're very thoughtful. Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah, she's been sick. Yeah.
Did you check the email?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, she's got. Yeah, we got to figure out another half credit somewhere. Yeah.
She wants me to remind you about that.
Yes, I know. I've emailed her back today and said I'm going to work on it. I'll work on it as soon as I can. I don't know what I'm going to do, but because when is she going to be able to come in and see me? Because we've got to figure this out together. Yeah. Yeah, she's not doing well. Miserable. Okay. Well, you tell her we'll be praying for her, and that we'll figure out something. Okay? Yeah.
In transformation that tetra hydrofolate goes through different oxidation states.
That's correct.
How many are they?
Well, you can see right here, 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 different oxidation states.
Okay.
Yeah. That's an oxidation state. See, this level, this the visual idea, this is most reduced, this is most oxidized. These are the same level of oxidation. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4 oxidation states, but there's like 6 varieties of it. That's the thiamine monophosphate. That I will get that. I will get to that on Monday. I mean on Wednesday. Okay, I'll bring back. I want to refer to that, and I will expand on that and give you some information about it. Okay, sorry.